Unbound Theatre presents The Chronicles of Professor Chronomier. What Runcible Saw. Written by Dario Knight and performed by Erica Sanderson. Of all Professor Elizabeth Chronomier's many friends, she had known none longer than Runcible. For the entire span of her memory, which was more detailed than most people's, he had been a part of her life, a close friend of her father who had helped to plan the elder Chronomier's many explorations across the globe. It was said that Runcible had read every book that had ever reached England. Through his appraisal of accounts of far-flung lands, he'd mapped the world ready for the professor's father to set sail and documented his travels for prosperity. A loyal archivist and bondsman, Runcible, through his maps, had always brought the professor's father safely home to her. Runcible himself was not one for travelling, but he loved stories. No sight, nor sound, nor smell of a distant shore could possibly outdo those in his imagination. Whenever a new account of a foreign adventure reached him, he would read it with childlike glee. When the professor's father returned from his travails with tales of distant lands, Runcible would sit and listen with unwavering attention, taking in each and every word with care. And he forgot nothing. As the years had passed, it was the professor herself who had embarked on the adventures, and Runcible had continued his cherished duties of preparing her for the trip, and then listening eagerly to its details when she came back home. Through the professor and her father, Runcible had travelled the whole of the wide world without ever leaving his home. And home to Runcible was his shop. Runcible's emporium, situated in an unassuming side street in central London, was what some customers might call eclectic. Other, less whimsy-inclined patrons would call it a comprehensive mess. Whichever description you preferred, all who'd ever crossed its threshold could agree that it was full. It consisted of a large, simple room, one wall taken up by a grubby, mullioned window facing the street, and the other three lined from floorboard to ceiling plaster with shelves. Many of these were packed twice over with mismatched books, larger tomes visible here and there behind the outer rows of more compact titles. Where there were no books, there were other treasures. Peculiar objects and curios gathered from every continent on the planet. Some were ornate pieces carved from dark wood or sculpted from foreign clays, whilst others had been cast from rough metal beaten into some exquisite shape symbolic of the land of its origin. Dotted throughout the shop were a magnificent collection of glass bottles of every shape and size imaginable, each containing a roll of parchment. Some sat on the shelves, whilst others were supported by collections of intricately woven textiles and piles of thick paper covered in beautiful illustrations. The fact that the more fragile wares in Runcible's shop remained unbroken was particularly impressive given the other mainstay of the shelving, a mischievous-looking ginger cat. Named Hermes after the Greek god of travel, trade and cunning, Runcible's pet performed several duties within the shop. Naturally, Hermes prevented mouse incursions from troubling the premises, but he was equally adept at chasing off unwanted visitors of the human variety too. No criminal worth their mettle in the shadowy underworld of London was without a scar or two of Hermes' making, especially if they'd set out to pilfer something from Runcible's shop. As well as guard-in-chief, the ginger feline was also proficient at dusting, taking regular constitutionals along the length of each shelf and sweeping away the cobwebs with a swish of his tail, whilst miraculously avoiding any of the delicate objects Runcible had collected. At present, Hermes was dozing on a shelf near the ceiling, his tail absent-mindedly polishing the various tomes behind him whilst he purred. He had ascended to such a height by scaling the many stacks of books and journals that sat before the shelves, edging their way toward the centre of the room and topped by more talismans and trinkets. Some towers had grown so high that they now maintained a constant teeter that would alarm any customer uninitiated in the shopkeeper's own particular philosophy of stock management. Runcible had long since abandoned the futile notion of categorization for his wares. At some point, almost beyond the grasp of even his impeccable memory, he had grouped his books together first by subject, and then by alphabetical order, initially by author, and then by title. Soon after this, as the chaos only a truly open mind can create took hold of the shelves, the alphabet valiantly surrendered, and so too did the notion of order. Now the shop was simply full. Gloriously, daftly full. Thousands of books, hundreds of handmade gifts, and one thug of a cat. Sitting at the centre of the shop was an enormous mahogany table, beautifully decorated with intricate carvings of strange beasts from the pages of mythology. Flanking the table were tea chests packed with rolled-up sheets of paper and canvas. Across the far side of the room was what appeared at first to be a fortress made from a stack of books, but which on closer inspection was in fact Runcible's desk. Its wooden top was just visible through the clutter. Anyone visiting the shop would have been unwise to touch the stacks of book beneath it, which had replaced the counter's legs long ago. Runcible himself could be heard in the back room, rummaging through yet more piles of merchandise and muttering to himself absent-mindedly. The room lay behind a low, narrow archway set into the wall behind the desk, the sole concession to shelf space in the entire shop, saving the window and main entrance. Runcible shuffled through the arch, which curiously appeared to curve to his exact height and breadth, and emerged onto the shop floor. Much like his shop, Runcible was a man with little tolerance of neatness and order. His trousers were covered in dust, and his shirt was lumpy and misshapen. He wore a long patchwork gown, faded with age, and a pair of comfy slippers that had passed the point of needing repair and were now firmly in need of disposal. His hair was an explosion of unruly grey locks, though its colour was partially determined by the amount of dust that had settled upon it. Runcible flitted from bookcase to bookcase, seemingly at random. He would pick a shelf, scan one or two titles, remove a few more to inspect the tomes sitting behind them, then tut or sigh and start again somewhere else without bothering to replace anything he'd moved. As well as scanning the many volumes with his eyes, he appeared to be sniffing them too. His nose led him around the shop floor, circling the mahogany table until he neared the window. Inhaling deeply, he caught the scent and his eyes widened with a smile.
"Got you now," he said,
and dived for the window display. For all his lack of order, Runcible could never be accused of lacking creativity. His shop window was considered the finest in London, or would be if he had bothered to clean the glass so that people could actually see it. Hermes had once attempted to lick the grime from the window panes, but even he had his limits. Nevertheless, the display could thrill the hearts of anyone who stopped to peer in at it. At its base was another pile of books, only these ones did have some form of order to them. Runcible had collected as many volumes with blue covers as he could and piled them up in a haphazard fashion. Above them sat beautiful white decorations made of delicate fabrics and strings, and atop the books sat a magnificent model of a ship, a galleon sailing upon a sea of words. Runcible carefully sifted through the books until his hand, as if drawn by some outside force, latched on to one particular volume and plucked it from the literary ocean. He straightened up and held the book before him, a sense of trepidation washing over him. He stroked the cover with one hand, feeling the warmth of the sun still lingering upon it. Turning it over and over to inspect the spine and edges of the pages, Runcible glanced up at Hermes, who had awoken from his slumber and was now sitting on his shelf looking down at the old man. Hermes blinked, flicked his tail, and then Runcible nodded in return. He opened the book and slowly turned the first few pages. Then he saw it. A large dark stain had blotted out almost all of the words on the page. It was no spillage. It was a scorch mark, as though the sunshine that had managed to penetrate the grotty windows had bypassed the faded cover and begun to burn the paper within. Runcible turned to the next page, revealing a smaller black stain. The mark continued across the next dozen or so pages, getting smaller and smaller each time, resembling the damage a pot of ink might have inflicted had it been poured onto the text to seep through successive chapters.
"I knew it,"
Runcible muttered darkly beneath his breath. He walked over towards Hermes and held the spoiled book up to him. The cat sniffed the pages, dabbing his nose against the black mark, then quickly recoiled and shook his head as if to banish the scent.
"Come on,"
Runcible urged.
"We're both past our best, but you can find him quicker than I can."
Hermes appeared to weigh up the blunt comment about his age with his affection for the old man, then raised himself up and began making his way along the shelf, his nose twitching towards each of the books in turn. Runcible watched nervously as Hermes stopped and pored at a slim volume of verse from a justly obscure poet. He teased it away from the shelf and sent it plummeting to the floor. Runcible dashed over and picked it up. There again was the dark burn mark permeating through the pages. He ran his fingers over the blot. It was dry and smooth, as though it had been printed upon the paper along with the clumsy metaphors and excruciatingly saccharine imagery.
"Well,"
Runcible sighed,
"we won't mourn that one, but all the same..."
He was interrupted by the sound of another book hitting the ground. Hermes had dropped down to the lower shelf on the adjacent wall. Before Runcible could pick up the next volume, two more rained down in quick succession. He did not need to inspect them. One had fallen open when it landed, displaying pages entirely covered in scorch marks. Runcible looked up from the books to the walls of densely packed shelves surrounding him.
"How many more?"
he asked Hermes, who had seated himself atop a pile of historical records.
"And where the hell's it coming from?"
That night, Runcible slept and dreamt of the professor. In the decades he'd known her, she had become a daughter to him, and ever since her father's passing, he had adopted the worries of a parent whenever she went off on her excursions. That morning, she had stopped by the shop to pick up a very peculiar map. Usually she tasked him with providing the most up-to-date atlases of distant continents, but this time she had asked for an old Elizabethan design, one that depicted a London long ago. She had told him nothing of why she needed that map in particular. That wasn't like her. He could always tell when there was travelling afoot. The anticipation of the journey always quivered in her voice. It had done so that morning, but she had said nothing of a trip abroad. He'd been given his orders. He was to keep an eye on her house in Atwell Street and feed Sydney the tortoise. But where had she gone? How long would it take her to return? And why had it been such a secret? Whilst Runcible frowned through his uneasy sleep, Hermes was hard at work. He had taken Runcible's question of where the dark stains were coming from with the utmost severity, and so, following an afternoon nap, a saucer of tuna, a post-meal snooze, and an early evening slumber, Hermes had gotten to work. He'd paced every shelf in the shop twice over, examined each stack of books and papers, sniffed every knick-knack and souvenir that could be found, and still he could not find the source. The smell of the decay that blighted the books seemed to flit this way and that, as if to outrun him. Hermes didn't like being outrun. It reminded him of his advancing years, and there was nothing to be gained from entertaining that notion. So the search had continued. As night became morning, he found it. The holler of a drunkard in the street outside momentarily distracted him, and then, in the corner of his eye when his head had turned, he could see a tremor in the air. He pounced, leaping from the floor and onto a shelf halfway up the wall. There were vibrations running along it, zipping up his legs as he approached the offending article. One of the books reeked of decay. He could practically see it steaming from the pages. He lifted a cautious paw, knocked the book to the ground, and then jumped down in pursuit. Like the tome Runcible had examined earlier, the book fell open onto the floor. The dark stains were there, but this time they were moving. They swirled and shifted, surged and shrank across the pages like clouds in the sky. This was the cause of it all. Hermes knew. He watched the inky creature that had sprung to life on the pages, then noticed it wasn't the only thing transforming in the moonlight that bathed the shop floor. The words on the page were changing too. Hermes had never learnt to read the human's language. He had no need to. He loved nothing more than curling up on Runcible's lap to listen to the old man read from his ever-expanding library. But the squiggles and shapes on the paper meant nothing to him when he was alone. All the same, he knew they weren't supposed to change. He slowly extended a paw and pulled at the pages, turning them over. The decay danced only in the final section of the book. Its beginning and middle remained the same. What was stopping it spreading to the rest of the story, Hermes wondered. Would Runcible know? He narrowed his eyes at the pages again, and, as though aware of the guard cat's unamused gaze, the decay began to retreat. Hermes looked at the words. They had settled again. Had they changed for good? Or had they reverted to how they always were? The answer could wait. He flicked the book closed again and then pushed it under the table. He briefly glanced at the words on the spine, yawned, and then walked away, leaving the biography of Christopher Marlowe for another day. Spring turned to summer, and the mould not having troubled them again, and the professor not having returned home, Runcible and Hermes welcomed a new shipment of glass bottles. Runcible had contacts all over the world who could get new finds diverted to him in London. Bottles were his particular area of interest. Not empty ones, mind. Runcible sought bottles with a story to tell. When the professor was a child, Runcible had told her, just as he told her father before her, that writing a message in a bottle and flinging it out to sea could help settle a troubled mind, give solace to a weary soul, even begin to mend a broken heart. It was a practice both elder and younger chronomiers had adhered to, partly because they knew those bottles had an unerring ability to end up in Runcible's shop. There was no better guardian for castaway thoughts than Runcible. This newest shipment had been amassed along the south coast of England. Some were caught in fishing nets, others washed up on the shore. One or two were plucked from the sea itself by curious trawlermen. All of them were destined for London, where Runcible studied every note with care. Some might have considered it an intrusion. Runcible felt it to be his duty, for every worried thought, he said, deserved to be listened to. Most of the letters in the hall were typical of the type, love letters and messages to the departed. Runcible and Hermes were nearing the bottom of the crate when the shopkeeper picked up a bottle much heavier than the others. The glass was of the same thickness, but the papers within were packed tight. One by one, Runcible extracted the pages. He never allowed himself the ease of smashing the glass, and laid them out on his desk. Each was a letter, all addressed to the same person and written in the same hand. He arranged them in date order, and then began to read. "My dear Cassandra, I should be appreciative if, for the next few weeks at least, you might use the above address for your letters. I find myself in residence at Wickfield Park for a prolonged period, at the insistence of Mr. Rivers. Young Grace Blackstone is quite well after her misfortunate accident on the main road. Such screaming all over a twisted ankle. It serves the foolish girl right for cavorting about off the pathway. Mr. Rivers has been a most conscientious host, and has also taken in young Miss Astrid, the waif I had twice encountered prior to Miss Blackstone's accident. She claims to have no home, and offers no information as to her background. Furthermore, she disappears for weeks on end without an explanation as to where she has been. Mr. Rivers insists he shall care for her until we can find a suitable plan to ensure her safety. She seems most interested in me, though I cannot understand why. Indeed, she claims not to know the source of her curiosity herself, and asks me all manner of searching biographical questions on some kind of instinct."
"Well, I'll be!" Runcible grinned as he neared the end of the letter. "Written by Jane Austen herself, no less. Hang on, though."
He moved across to a nearby stack of books and expertly removed a volume from halfway down without disturbing the others. It was a biography of Austen. He thumbed the pages and then looked at the date on the letter.
"Blimey, Hermes," Runcible gasped. "We found her lost letters."
This was the correspondence thought long absent from history. The story of Jane's hidden love.
"Well then, Miss Austin,"
Runcible asked of the treasured correspondence laid out before him.
"Who's this stranger of yours asking all the questions, then?"
He sorted through the letters and then began to read another. Curiously, it was dated the same day as the last, but the name at the bottom was different. One letter by Jane Camberwell, the other by Jane Big Withers. The second missive began, "My dear Cassandra, in these testing days I find myself blessed to have companions. Mr. Riley remains a reassuring presence whenever visiting Harris, and I am delighted that my most impromptu meeting with the esteemed Professor Cronomier has become a firm friendship."
"No!"
Runcible breathed in disbelief, before carrying on reading. "She is swathed in all manner of eccentricities, and seems most keen to learn of my life story in great detail. I am happy to oblige, though the last 3 years, of which she seems most intrigued, are still uneasy to speak on."
"It can't be,"
muttered Runcible, and Hermes mewed in agreement.
"Must be one of her relatives, surely. Hold up. What's going on here?"
The letters had begun to quiver. He could see a familiar dark stain spreading across their surface. The mould was back. Runcible and Hermes could only watch as each letter was swallowed up by the black smudge. Unlike the pages of the books, however, the transformation did not end there. Each piece of delicate paper shrank and crumbled into ashes on the desk, lost history fulfilling its title.
"When that girl gets back from wherever she's gone," Runcible told Hermes, "she's got a lot of explaining to do."
Summer turned to autumn, autumn turned to winter, and then the professor did indeed come back, just in time for Christmas. However, her return was such a dizzying and unexpected one that Runcible clear forgot to ask about the mysterious black mould. One winter's afternoon, she had reappeared in his shop, sat him down at his desk, and related the magnificent adventure she'd embarked upon, sailing across the sea of time in a ship of her own creation. Runcible listened in awe at the tale, a million maps conjured into being inside his mind. The two old friends had spent the festive period taming a curious creature that the professor had inadvertently brought back with her from the Time River. The bright blue imp was eventually sent home, and Runcible and the professor enjoyed Christmas in the company of Astrid, a charming if uncouth young girl whom the professor had met centuries back. Whilst Astrid and Hermes had curled up with a good book by the fire in the study upstairs, the professor had shown Runcible down to the basement, where her magnificent timeship lay in dock, awaiting another adventure. He'd marvelled at its intricate design, its elegant brass pillars reaching up to an hourglass set within a gyroscope, a marble floor beneath wooden control panels topped with all manner of glassware, and the great copper blades bending down to hug the frame of the ship. Together they had settled down with glasses of brandy, and the professor had spoken of her first great adventure, where not only had she met Astrid, but also the great playwright and royal spy, Christopher Marlowe. The evening intertwined with her stories, and both weaved their way into the night. Winter became spring, and the time came for the travellers to depart again, but not without leaving Runcible a gift.
"This ought to come in handy in the shop,"
the professor had said to him as she handed over a curious-looking gadget. It was fashioned mainly from metal, with a glass panel set into the surface. The sides of the device moulded to the shape of Runcible's hand.
"What does it do?"
he'd asked.
"Just point it at something in the shop,"
the professor had replied,
"and then give it a squeeze. You'll see."
Once the professor and Astrid had set sail again, Runcible had put the gift to the test. He picked up a toy soldier his father had made for him. Runcible didn't much care for soldiers, but he appreciated the craftsmanship. He placed the model on top of a pile of books, pointed the metal box at it, and then gently squeezed his hand around the device. A faint tremor shook the box for a split second, and then the glass panel lit up. Written across its surface was a date, 1814. Runcible's eyes widened as Hermes' fur bristled at a disturbance in the air. 1814 was the year the soldier had been made. It was impossible. How could the box know? Runcible quickly hurried over to a casket on one of the overstuffed shelves. He opened it up and took from it a pendant consisting of a stunning emerald set within a gold medallion. It had been made, he knew, for the coronation of Queen Anne. This would test the professor's magic box. He placed the precious jewel on the shelf, pointed the box at it, and squeezed. The same tremor, and once again the glass was illuminated. This time it bore the date 1702. The machine was correct.
Well, blow me down,
Runcible grinned. Hermes dutifully offered a hefty sigh, but the old man remained standing.
Best foot forward then, me old son. We've got work to do.
For day after day, Runcible and Hermes set about putting a date to every item in the shop. Even after scanning hundreds of books and treasures, Runcible's glee at the gift the professor had left him would not abate. He giggled and whooped each time a new item's date of origin was revealed, recording everything in an enormous ledger. One afternoon, Hermes ventured behind one of the bookcases and found a series of paintings Runcible hadn't thought about in years. The guard cat pulled them into the middle of the shop floor and set about dusting them. Some were portraits of austere-looking aristocrats. Others were landscapes of varying qualities. But the best of the collection depicted a sailing ship.
Well, would you look at that?
Runcible beamed when he saw it. He gave Hermes a congratulatory stroke of the head and then readied the scanner. He hesitated when he spotted something in the picture. Two people had been painted on the deck of the ship, which was sailing through an almighty storm. They were tiny details on the canvas, created with a few brief brushstrokes. But Runcible thought he could just about discern one of the figures wearing a familiar broad-brimmed hat.
It couldn't be.
Hermes nudged Runcible's hand, and he pointed the scanner at the painting. He squeezed. The tremor rippled through his fingers, and the screen lit up. Only this time, the numbers didn't settle. They kept fluctuating, as though the device could not decide which year the painting belonged to. Hermes meowed, and Runcible looked back at the canvas. The two figures had gone, replaced by a black spot that blended into the storm clouds. The numbers on the scanner were still flitting back and forth. Runcible shook the device, hoping it would calm itself. Hermes ran over to the table and reached a paw underneath. He sent the book he had hidden months before skidding across the floorboards, straight to Runcible's feet. He picked it up.
Funny,
he said.
I thought we'd done all the books.
He turned it over and inspected the spine.
Christopher Marlowe, eh?
He recalled the professor's story of meeting the mysterious man, and then held the book up and scanned it. The metal box began to tremble, and this time it didn't stop. Runcible dropped both book and scanner, sending them tumbling to the ground. Once landed, the book's pages began to turn, as though moved by a non-existent breeze. Every page was black. The numbers on the scanner screen moved faster and faster, until a spark of energy erupted from its inner workings and the screen went blank.
Well then,
said Runcible in a resigned tone.
Back to the old way of doing things.
Spring turned to summer, and Runcible and Hermes embarked on their monthly trip to the theatre. Ordinarily, the Regency didn't allow animals inside, but Hermes was able to hide in a weather-worn Gladstone bag that Runcible would sneak past the ushers and then pop out just in time for curtain up. This month's play was a farce set in the English countryside. Two city gentlemen had found themselves in a stately home where they'd become romantically involved with a pair of society ladies who just so happened to be identical twins. The inevitable tangle of mistaken identities had ensued, and mixed with a contrived plot concerning the servants, a missing turkey and a silver salver, the audience had roared with laughter. Hermes was not amused. Normally he liked to hear the humans' laughter. It rang in the air and tickled his ears, but this evening he could sense there was trouble afoot. He jumped down from Runcible's lap to look at a programme a nearby woman had dropped amid an explosion of laughter. He looked at the words printed on the front. Just like the book at the shop, they were changing, and they weren't alone. Runcible wiped tears of laughter from his eyes as the latest comical set piece reached its crescendo. His gleeful applause came to a halt when a silvery streak of light shot across the auditorium towards the stage. Everyone in the audience save for he and Hermes froze as though in a photograph. Runcible got to his feet and looked around. The silver light had struck the scenery and was dancing around its edges like a glittering fringe. Gradually the stage set began to transform, followed by the actors' costumes. The farm became a drawing room. The downstairs servants were retailored as well-to-do society types. Runcible heard Hermes call to him. He looked down and saw the cat pawing at a program. He picked it up, and this time he too could see the transforming writing. In the Country, the title of the farce, became The Importance of Being Earnest. That wasn't a play he recognized. The author's name changed too. Instead of Harrison Guthrie, it now read Oscar Wilde. Who was he when he was at home? Runcible looked back up at the stage. The actors were bowing now, and the sound of applause was bubbling up from the silence, though the audience remained stock still, trapped in a snapshot of existence. A tall man with leonine hair stepped onto the stage and took a bow. He looked down at the front row, where one of the theatre-goers had begun to move. She was waving a large hat in the air and cheering loudly. Beside her was a younger, shorter woman, whistling loudly and shouting her support. It was the Professor and Astrid.
"What are you two doing here?"
Runcible called. The two friends turned, and the man on stage looked up. Instinctively, Runcible knew that this was the playwright himself, Oscar Wilde. Oscar and the two travellers met Runcible's gaze, but then in an instant they were gone, along with the drawing room and the society gowns. In the Country returned to the stage, and the audience resumed motion, rocking in their seats with laughter. Runcible sat back down, stunned, and looked at the programme in his hand, which was quickly disintegrating into ashes. In the days to come he would search for Oscar Wilde, but no such author could be found. Had it been a dream, he would eventually ask himself. The professor would know. The next time she returned home, he would find out everything. Summer turned to autumn as the mould began to spread. It started to creep from the books to the shelves, and then from the shelves to the walls. Runcible and Hermes set to work attempting to scrub the shop clean, but the stain would not shift. It was as though the scorch marks had always been there, replacing the surfaces Runcible and Hermes once knew. A respite came when the newspaper arrived. Runcible made himself a cup of tea and poured some into a saucer for Hermes. They sat at the mahogany table and looked through the various articles until one on page 7 ensnared their attention. It was about a new collection of artefacts that had arrived in the British Museum just across town. They dated back to the Roman occupation of Britain, and, it was rumoured, offered hitherto unknown information about Boudicca, the famous warrior queen of the Iceni.
"Now then," grinned Runcible, setting the newspaper down on the table. "That sounds like an outing to me."
He looked across at Hermes, who winked, swished his tail, and then went to fetch his Gladstone bag. A few hours later, Runcible placed the bag down carefully under a table in the reading room of the British Museum. It was a great circular chamber, the curved wall, like the ones in Runcible's shop, packed floor to ceiling with shelves of books. The difference here was order. The sheer uniformity of the volumes made Runcible feel quite uncomfortable. The museum was about to close. Runcible liked this time of day. The clutter of noisy and nosy academics had moved on, leaving him alone with the museum's latest acquisitions laid out on the expansive wooden desks. Aside from his and Hermes' footsteps, the only sound to be heard was the ticking of the clocks, which lined the round wall at regular intervals, reminding readers of the time. Always useful in a library, thought Runcible, for time bore little meaning when you were lost in a good story. Among the artefacts were items of jewellery and the occasional mosaic, fragments of earthenware pottery and battered axe heads. A few pieces of cloth had miraculously survived, along with scraps of parchment. What drew Runcible's attention immediately, though, were the illustrations. Seemingly torn from the pages of a book, The colourful drawings depicted the Roman army and the Saxon tribes who had resisted their conquest of Britain. There were depictions of centurions and soldiers battling one another, followed by triumphant leaders standing over the bodies of the dead. And then there was Boudica. She appeared in many of the drawings, sometimes astride a horse, sometimes riding in a chariot. In some instances she was depicted in battle, in others at repose. One drawing portrayed her standing protectively over two small girls. Rumour abounded that Boudica had raised two daughters, but history held no record of what had become of them when the warrior queen's time had ended. Now here they were, recorded in a drawing, and beneath them were written their names, Eowyn and Mildretha.
"Fascinating,"
Runcible breathed, as Hermes leapt up onto the table and followed the old man's gaze. His feline nose twitched as he looked at the illustration. A familiar smell. Something was wrong. Runcible returned his attention to the other portraits of Boudica, wondering if they might have once belonged to a full-printed account of her life. What he wouldn't give to be able to scan its pages. He paused when he found an illustration of someone entirely different. This was of a hooded figure surrounded by the branches of dead trees. The ground beneath her was crimson-red. The drawing was labelled Andraste, the Saxon goddess of victory. Something drew Runcible's gaze deep into the drawing. He looked at the hooded head, as though determined to find a face somewhere within. His eyes began to ache, and he shook his head to break the hold the illustration held over him. Hermes tiptoed over in concern, and he scratched the feline's ears gently.
"Time to turn in,"
Runcible muttered. He moved away from the drawing of the goddess and returned to the family portrait. His eyes widened. He closed them and concentrated, recalling the image he had seen moments before. He reopened his eyes once again and looked at the image. It had changed. The two girls were gone, and now Boudica stood alone, her head bowed. Runcible thought back to the programme at the theatre, as Hermes recalled the ever-changing book in the shop. The lamps lighting the room all flickered, and a breeze rose up from out of nowhere. The artefacts on the table shook but remained in place, save for the drawing of the goddess, which lifted up into the air. Runcible made a grab for it, but it flew out of reach. He turned back to the table. The breeze had pushed some of the drawings aside, revealing another hitherto hidden beneath. It was in the same style as the others, though the content was wholly different. At the centre was a curious chamber made up of brass pillars, copper blades, wooden panels, and a marble floor. Fear crept up in Runcible's throat. He had seen this before, back at Christmas, in the basement laboratory in Atwell Street. Standing beside the object were Eowyn and Mildretha, their faces full of fear. And at the heart of the impossible construct, the ship that sailed on the River of Time, stood the Professor. The lamps flickered again, and Hermes cried a warning, but Runcible was once again transfixed by the illustration. As he looked, the drawings of Boudica's daughters disappeared from the page. The Professor's head bowed in shame, and the familiar dark stain began to appear in the corners of the page, creeping towards the centre. Another flicker of light, another wailed warning, and then the Professor herself began to change. Her face disappeared, replaced with a fierce visage framed by a mass of curly hair. The new occupant of the machine was lined with silver veins, as though their skin were breaking apart. Runcible watched as an evil grin spread across the woman's face. The black marks were closing in now, and the page was crumbling. Something stirred in Runcible's memory. He had seen that face before. Flashes of remembrance blinked across his mind, and at last he knew who she was.
"Madeline,"
he whispered. The Professor's lost love. Madeline glared at him from the illustration. The darkness claimed the intricate drawing of the Professor's timeship, and then swallowed Madeline herself. Thunder ripped across the sky outside, and Runcible finally looked up from the table. Another gust of wind sent the other artifacts tumbling from the table, where they too turned to dust. Runcible wasn't watching. Instead, He turned slowly on the spot and looked at the reading room in horror. The lights were almost out now, but they still burned brightly enough to show what Hermes had been warning him about. The walls of the room were stained black, books tumbling from the shelves and bursting into clouds of ash. The darkness spread across the floor and the ceiling, consuming everything in its path. All around the room, the faces of the clocks began to crack and shatter.
"Beg!"
Runcible shouted as the thunder returned. Hermes leapt inside before Runcible picked it up and ran for the door. He pulled it open and then glanced back at the ruined library. He thought of the illustration of the professor, remembered her in the theatre with the man named Wilde, and then in the painting of the ship. He thought of Jane Austen's lost letters and the ruined biography of Marlowe. Each and every time, the decay had come for her.
"Oh, my girl,"
Runcible said quietly as he watched the room collapse into darkness.
"What have you done?"
The Chronicles of Professor Chronomier, What Runcible Saw, an Unbound Theatre production, written by Dario Knight and performed by Erica Sanderson, with music by Lou Sutcliffe.